And it's also like that, I think one of the things that's kind of, as the kind of Me Too conversation has matured, that kind of dynamic, you know, you can see that Harvey and the women in those rooms, that was all about professional access, but also economic.
It was bartering.
Exclusion.
That, yeah, but that's also why some people were so dismissive of the people who were assaulted, the complainants, the people who, the victims. I know people don't like the word victim anymore, because they were like, oh, if you went to his room, you knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
You thought you could swap it.
Hello and welcome to Sex Power Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. Today I'm talking to Sophie Matheson. Sophie is an activist filmmaker and sugar baby from Australia. She is currently in production on her second feature film, an experiential documentary about the sugar dating phenomena. Today we're going to be talking about dating for cash, using the word feminist on a date, and marriage as transactional sex.
But it's like, it's kind of insane, because that's exactly what the men on seeking arrangement say. They're like, well, if you're on seeking arrangement, you know exactly why you're here. And it's like, do you know? Like, because you don't, like, there is such a, I think, the genderedness of what that knowing is.
Yeah. Well, the rule books are so different. So that's one thing when I was researching for my book, and it is something that as a culture at the moment, it's quite comedic, men asking for money back after dates. And asking for, like, so one of those is this man, and he asked for $3.50 back off because he'd bought her like a creamy cooler and Costa coffee. And there's other ones, and it's usually small amounts of money, but actually there becomes an amount of money where there is a rule book, because if we're telling, and I'm not us, but if society is saying to young women, if a man spends a lot of money on you, it's because you're beautiful and he enjoys your company.
Yeah.
And that's so flattering. But a man is told, if you pay, she puts out. Otherwise, she doesn't let you pay.
Yeah.
Then that's very dangerous, even in, because there's still a transaction going on.
And weirdly, it's kind of like, this is the thing with seeking arrangement, because the offer is of a luxury lifestyle.
Yes.
There is, what uni student can afford a luxury lifestyle? So already, by the kind of, the way that that is set up, there is always an indebtedness from the women's side. And I think it was kind of interesting. I was very, very clear in the start that I would never let any of the men pay when it was never about that, because from my perspective, I was like, the minute I start to accept that largesse or that benevolence, there's going to be some quid pro quo, and I am journalistically trying to be present here.
Yes.
So it needs to be Dutch in order for me to all remain some objectivity. Yes. And it's like, I mean, it's crazy.
It's very interesting. It's very, very interesting, because money underwrites all of our relationships, yet we live our lives like it doesn't. But I want to, because I found it so exciting what you were saying outside. So you had audio. So you're making a film.
Yes.
You're interviewing a man.
Yes.
And he's explaining what happened after his divorce financially.
Yes. So he basically, so the film that I'm making at the moment is called Sugar, and it's basically a first person investigative documentary into seeking arrangement, but the phenomena of sugar dating and what that is and how it's being kind of, I guess, positioned in society. So over 2 years, I went on 86 dates with men who, men and one woman who I had found through seekingarrangement.com, which has now been rebranded as Seeking. But basically one of the questions that I would always ask these men is, why not an escort? You know, this is like, what are your feelings about sex work? Like, why wouldn't you do this? And one of the things that I would hear is, one, they didn't want to be with sex workers because
there's a real snobbery, isn't there?
It is crazy.
But it's all this exactly the same stigma. But the idea that you get something, and that they sometimes use this kind of word, like purer, that they'd much rather pay for someone, a regular woman, and put in speech marks, rather than, like, as if something happens to you once you've started selling sex, you're not a regular woman anymore. Yeah.
And it was kind of crazy that the word that, and we kind of, we're still playing around with the idea that this is what the film might be called. I heard the word authentic all the time.
Yeah.
This is authentic. And I was like, mate, you don't even know my real name. Yes. Like, literally, this is so far from
being
authentic.
But also, it happens with men who do use escorts or pay for sex. They also want to believe that women are really enjoying themselves, which is why when I was reading Punternet and all these men really, really complaining, it was because that bubble was burst. It wasn't authentic. she didn't want to have sex with him.
Yeah.
But, and also, I want to shout at them, none of them want to have sex with
no,
you. That's why
no.
you're paying them.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's you know, and that's the whole thing. The reason that sugar daddies really like that is because the economic transaction is veiled behind this idea of help. So I'm not paying
yes.
you.
Yes.
They really, what I found was that there was such a disdain for the transaction.
Yes.
They hate
so, it. So they try and kind of veil it. They obviously get to give themselves, I'm judging them now, a little pat on the back of like, this is generativity.
Yes.
This is actually, society is set up in a way where I'm rich, you're poor, but I'm leveling the playing field a little bit with my dick.
Yeah. And also it's like, you know, they're genuinely helping a woman to get ahead in the world. So they're kind of share. The thing that's kind of interesting is that because it denies them any kind of acknowledgement of their privilege, because in a a traditional sex work transaction, there is a knowingness that I am paying you, and who are the people who are consistently paying you? It's men. Now, what does that say on a kind of deep philosophical level?
Okay,
men have privilege. Now, I think one thing, like doing all of these dates over a long period of time, I went through these kind of peaks and troughs of like, oh, I feel really sad for these men. They all feel like wallets. Yeah. And then I hate all men.
Yes.
They are garbage.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of this whole thing.
Yeah.
But because there's no understanding that it is a privilege to be able to see a sex worker and to have your intimate needs met with money that you can access.
Yeah.
Because there is no acknowledgement of that, they then feel more able to share their privilege in a way that, you know, it's kind of...
I wonder as well if there's... So in terms of a power dynamic, and obviously the money and power dynamic is so interrelated, but what you have in just a sex transaction is a money exchange for sex power. It might actually be more levelling than this idea. I think there's actually more of a power... what do I mean? There's more of a gap in power between...
Disparity.
Yeah. There's more of a disparity in power between a daddy who's like enabling your entire life, like a dependency that then continues.
Yeah.
Is actually, I think they're getting off on that as well.
100%.
There must be an element of... And I'm sure when you say like feeling sorry for them being wallets, I do understand that because most human beings desperately want to be loved.
Yeah.
And the awareness that this person is pretending or going along with something because of the money must occasionally burst their bubble.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, they... A lot of these men were very lonely, very isolated, you know, really without...
What kind of jobs did they do to have money?
I mean, the thing with me is that I would meet anyone who would want to meet me.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yes.
So... You know, the fantasy that they're all hedge fund managers is not anything.
They're not all like city bankers.
No.
Kind of,
you know, some guys are just like, I'm an engineer, I'm a civil engineer, and I've got a little bit of extra cash. And I was like, wow, I mean, even if I had a regular white collar job, I still wouldn't have that money to splash around.
Yes.
And I was like, you know, it is kind of crazy that the fantasy that the website sells is that they're all, you know, diamond members, this thing where they're kind of like high rollers. And they're not. They're just kind of like regular middle management
dudes. I guess
that's
less sexy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I guess they want to see themselves that way as well.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of, I mean, I feel really sorry for him, but it is kind of hilarious. There was a an MP, quite a conservative MP in Australia who was outed as an active member of Seeking Arrangement at the end of last year.
Yeah.
His name was Andrew Broad, and he was calling himself Australian James Bond. You know, it was this Australian 007 or something as his profile. And so this sugar baby was just like, he was a real weirdo, and I actually found out that he was in Parliament, and, you know, what a surprise. Mm. He was trying to limit abortion.
How did he get outed?
The sugar baby, actually.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she kind of released some...
Because that's a very... And another interesting kind of transactional sex is kiss and telling, because they get paid for their stories, the people who do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is a way of literally humiliating someone publicly and getting paid for it.
And I think that that, again, speaks to the stigmatization and why men on the website, on Seeking Arrangement, don't want to associate themselves with sex workers, because there
they
is flack.
More vulnerable.
Yeah, there's flack, I think, that's given to everyone. If you see a sex worker, you know, like that ridiculous campaign where I think it was Ashton Kutcher, and it's like, real men don't buy girls.
Yes, yes,
and you're like...
Yeah. There were lots of people did it. It's on YouTube.
And it's like, well, what does that say? You're reinforcing binary notions.
It's toxic masculinity.
You know, like real men. And it's like, like, what is that?
It's like saying, like, real women aren't for sale. It's like, who are you talking to, and do you not know how horrible you're being? Yeah, I think a lot of people with those campaigns, it happened, I thought, with the Amnesty when they were talking about decrim and legalisation, is that people get asked to do something and assume that it's right. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure Ashton Kutcher did not spend a lot of time thinking about what the campaign was. Someone said, we're doing this thing to kind of help trafficking.
Yeah,
and he'd been like, yeah, I'm there.
Well, I think this is the whole thing with the foster ancestor laws, you know.
Just interrupting the podcast to clarify, foster ancestor. If you've never heard those phrases before, you should really look it up and find out more. These are laws that have come in under Donald Trump and affect American sex workers, meaning that they are now unable to advertise their services on online platforms.
And I think, you know, one of the things when I was starting my film was recognizing, I don't know if you've seen a film called Being Jane Doe, but
no.
That was a very, and I think it's a bit of a fraught title, because effectively it's on the surface, it looks like it's an impact documentary that's about ending sex trafficking.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
However, what it does is completely attacks Backpage, and it was one of the major drivers in terms of popularizing that. And, you know, one of the things that we're not talking about is now that that has been removed, that then forces sex workers back into more dangerous positions.
Oh, it's, for the people who are dependent on it, it's a little bit like going into B&Q and going, some murderers get their axes from here. So no, we have to close B&Q, because obviously the people, the traffickers who were using it, and of course there's that story, Reply All, did an amazing documentary, and they actually did a very balanced one, but it starts with the woman whose 16-year-old daughter was killed on her 16th birthday, and she was advertised as an underage trafficking victim on Backpages. So there are things that are so emotive.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, actually, with things that are very emotive, is you can't have a rational discussion afterwards. You just go, stop killing 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
Cancel it, Backpage. Like,
And it's like, you know, I think that until we do talk about how do you, you know, I think societally we don't want to regulate anything, because it's never deemed about what it actually is about, which is money.
Yeah.
For us, it's about morality.
Yeah. And you then have to look at, actually, that's what I think is very interesting, is that when people get to the paying for sex thing, we have to have a discussion about the fact that we all work for money anyway. And for a huge swathe of people, that is work they don't want to do.
Yeah.
And whatever variety that is, we
and
also see it as a human right to be able to pay your rent and
totally
eat. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's kind of, you know, over the course of making the film and seeing, you know, spending a long period of immersion in in the sugaring world, is to actually go, you know, the lie of it is that it is, you know, Brandon Wade, the founder of Seeking Arrangement, he says it's not a job, it's an art. And that's like, literally, it's the same thing as Uber saying, you're not my employees.
Yes.
You're just making some extra cash on the side.
Yeah, you're all tradesmen of your own volition.
Yeah, you're all entrepreneurs. Mm. And it's like, fuck off. No, like, actually.
But it is how legally you can just step away from any responsibility.
Yeah. But it's like, it's a really tough thing, because sugaring is a job, and it is one of, you know, the worst jobs I think I've ever had in my entire life.
Yes.
Because it's hard. Yeah. You're constantly dealing with men's very fragile emotions. Mm. You're constantly, like, I recognize that for, you know, and a lot of the sex workers that we spoke to during the filming of the film was basically saying, I would never do that because these guys just want to have access to me 24/7. And it's true.
I see. So people who did more classical escorting by the hour wouldn't do sugar daddy.
But like these guys, like I still get text messages from rando dudes like from 2 years ago being like, hey, what's up? What are you doing? And it's like, I'm not your girlfriend. I'm not. I'm just a random person from a website. But there is this acknowledgement. I think because the facade says these women really want to be here.
Yes.
It's not about the money.
Yeah.
They then go, well, I can kind of treat you like I would.
That's what I thought was very... So when I looked at the website, one of the things that I thought was very interesting, because my main area of interest is that we have this ongoing stigma about sex, and that comes from the fact that we can't separate our biology, the fact that it created babies, and then years and years and years of stigma about the fact that women might have children by men. So the fact that it was always saying don't sleep on a first date. And I thought, this like idea that that's not what anyone's there for.
Yeah.
This idea of like, no, the first date is to find out if you get on. It's like, come on, don't try and be classy about this. You're not my mother. But that's essentially what they were saying to people is the classy thing to do is no sex.
But it's like, it's kind of insane. Like I went, so I went on a date with Brandon Wade, the founder, which was in and of itself kind of a quiet.
So you asked him, you said, will you come and speak to me?
Well, actually I got my male producer to ask him instead because every time I had tried to interview him in the 2 years previously. He just was too busy. So, you know, he was too busy. I turned up to
his office. Is he married?
He's divorcing his third sugar baby wife.
Sugar baby wife?
Yeah, he finds all of his wives from his own website. So
that's handy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they get paid even though they're married to him?
Look, I don't know about that.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I know that he is very much of the opinion that the traditional setup of what he considers traditional values, which is like the man is the provider, the woman is the provided for.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I imagine their relationship is. Because, I have no idea.
And he thinks that is the right, that's the ideal for humanity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think men with money do think that much more because they can provide. And obviously it makes them, it kind of reassures them of some kind of masculinity. I think this is where men of lower economic status are really struggling with the current discussions around masculinity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they're getting very conflicting messages. But the message that you don't need to look after anyone.
Yeah,
it's like, we all work now. Be yourself.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's a tricky one because it's like it's kind of a bit of a catch 22 because, you know, the women and I went to this sugar baby conference, summit in LA, which
just sounds so delicious, doesn't it?
Oh my God, it was so like I was just like, what? Where am I? Yeah. Like, you know, it's a weekend kind of like conference with expert people who are talking about how to dress for daddy, and you know, here is how to make an ideal sugar budget and make sure that you keep a line item in for things like, you know, additional costs. Like, you, if you get your nails done every week, you'll also need to make sure that you have, like, you know, top ups and blah. And so don't forget those things. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, I bite my nails and, you know, I look.
Well, I guess this is what's so interesting about erotic capital is the input into it.
Erotic capital is a phrase referring to the social value an individual has as a result of their sexual attractiveness. And as with other forms of capital, it is exchangeable for social capital and economic capital, which is money.
Like, you do invest in erotic capital as well as...
I spent so much more money when I was doing the sugaring things than
but
I
also,
did as a regular human.
Yeah, if I was going to date someone who I thought had expectations because he was paying, I would have to shave. Like, I couldn't
and
turn
not
up.
Not even just the front of your legs, the back too.
And my armpits. Like, there'd be all these things where I'd be like, he's going to be like, this is not value for money. This donkey has turned
but
up.
Seriously, it was like... After a while, I was really conscious of the fact that I just, you know, I didn't dress in the way that I was expected to, you know, like
again, all of my preconceptions and judgments. I can't imagine you'd be able to express one would be able to express their way of being a woman in an individual way. You would have to go, it would be really stereotypical. You'd wear skirts and heels and makeup and...
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think one of
you couldn't turn up in dungarees.
No, I mean, which would be my preference, literally. But it's... you have to kind of... Okay, so there were kind of phases of the experiment, I guess, where one where I was as my sugar baby persona, which was called Hope. So Hope acted in a specific way and she, you know, did the thing that the profile said that she did and blah, blah, blah. So I was a different version of myself.
So a bit like a kind of a performative.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was she in comparation to you?
Like
you
must have was close. She was she was working in the film industry, but she wasn't making content. She was producing other people's stuff.
And enabling.
That was enabling, because obviously that's less threatening.
It's much less threatening.
To men.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I was like, to be honest, I was the kind of version of myself that I was when I was trying to, or when I was an actor, you know, and doing the audition circuit. You're pleasant and kind and open and empathetic and all of those things, and you nod and you smile. And
all the mirroring.
Yeah.
It makes people feel interesting and liked. And,
yeah. And it was that. And it's, you know, after a while or a year of doing that, you're like, this is tiring and boring.
And so you were dating these men.
Yeah.
With this kind of pseudonym. But just to kind of get to know them and what it was about.
Yeah, and to try and really understand, because from my perspective, the sugaring is always, and I think most sex work is, it's always being told from a retrospective position of the sex worker or the sugar baby.
Yes.
So she's rationalising her decision, which means that she carries the full weight and responsibility of that phenomena.
Yes.
So you see this on the kind of panel shows. It's usually Brandon Wade and a sugar baby going, well, I needed to get through college. Now, where are the daddies in this?
Yes. So also, the educational narrative is quite interesting. So, you know, within everything, there's almost like a legitimate version.
Yeah.
So, and it's the same with stripping and certain things. A woman who's doing it for the greater good, for some like really wholesome reason, is the best version.
Yeah.
And the most acceptable version. It's the version that people who are outside any kind of sex industry will go, well, that makes sense. She's one of the, she's plucky, doing her best.
Yeah. Yeah.
It gives it a wholesomeness because a woman sitting there going, I like money.
Yeah.
And I'll have sex for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of like, no.
Yes, yeah, like, what?
But it's also like, you know, I just think that when, I think that there is still stigma that's attached to women who are still trying to get even just their bills paid or their education fees or tuition.
Well, I guess there's a this is where we have this conflation of society, because we're moving in this direction going like, women can do anything they want.
Yeah.
Women should be more autonomous. Society should be set up in a way where every single child, no matter who they're born to, is entitled to an education, and after that education, choices.
Yeah.
But if their choice is stripping or sex work, there's certain things you go, no, you didn't hear us.
Yeah.
What we meant was,
you don't
have to do that anymore. Because now
you know about Pythagoras.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't know, I just think that one of the things that's kind of really insane is that we're not kind of looking at the lack of choices within regular employment models.
Yes.
And, you know, the kind of liberal ideology of choice is very flawed in and of itself. I think that, you know, not all choices are the same and not all choices are choices. Some choices are, you know, a string of kind of implicit choices or just things that are out of your control.
Well, that's what I think is interesting about people reflecting on things they've done when they're younger, no matter what they are, but especially if they did involve kind of erotic behaviours or people might have a very, very different feeling 15 years later about something they did in their 20s.
Yeah.
And sometimes they might see economic coercion or societal coercion in a way they didn't at the time. At the time they went, I'm surviving, I'm doing this. And, and actually you might look back and go, I was young, this person manipulated me, or the situation meant I didn't feel I had lots of choices.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, it's the women I think who are, you know, and it's very clear that they kind of target students and they target students because the state is not supporting education in the same way.
Yeah, it's making it more and more expensive and more difficult.
Exactly.
For students.
And it's like, you know, one of the things that's not being spoken about, and when I, the last time I was in Vegas with the Seeking Arrangement team, and I was talking to some of the women who worked for the website, you know, they were all talking about, you know, I got this job at the height of the crash, the 2008 crash, and you know, some of my friends are on the site but I work for it. Whew. And it's like, whoa, okay.
Yes.
So like, what we're not talking about is the fact that, you know, particularly, and this is what I saw in Australia a lot, is that a lot of the women who were utilizing the website, they were usually people who had moved from a smaller town to a bigger city to study for more educational opportunities.
Yeah.
They were without support and without the economic kind of safety net of a lot of people who were raised in a bigger place or at least had family or friends around.
Yeah.
And they needed flexibility. So the, and also they didn't want to work for shitty wages at yes. all hours of the night.
Yeah.
And, you know, and sugaring provided them an option that wasn't just that.
Yes.
And I think actually, you know, when you say, as you did before, it's kind of like, why would you want to work for £6 an hour when yes. you can make 200?
Yeah.
Also add into that when you have to be at your best because you recognize that you are studying in a place that, you know, potentially you could never afford again.
Yes.
And you need to make the most of this opportunity because this is the thing that's going to set you up.
Yes.
You're going to want something and that means that you're not going to be tired or exhausted.
Of course,
And it's also, you know, this is something that's not really spoken about, but when I was in LA and I was talking to a lot of sugar babies and they were like, you know, I've got a 2-year-old at home and this is, you know, this is flexible.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah.
Which sex work is in general.
It is. You know, and it's not to say, like, we're not talking, rather than going, well, that's just bad, we're not talking about the inflexibility of the structure as it is.
Yeah.
That actually creates that sex work as a much more, I guess, What's the word that I'm looking for?
Yeah.
Like a much more balanced way to live your life
yes.
because you're not having to compromise
yeah.
in the same way. And now, obviously, that's from a very privileged perspective yeah.
and
of sex work.
And it's also kind of denying, it's a way to talk about it without talking about any of the logistics of having sex
yeah.
for money because there's this way that you can kind of separate the two things because when you get, for me, it's particularly complicated. And I say that as someone who's never had sex for money. But that's where it gets complicated because I don't want to make it sound so great and easy. And these women have these flexible lives and it's just like working in Sainsbury's, except it's only an hour.
Yeah.
When there are tolls and complications and traumas that come with choosing to sell sex or having to sell sex.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's very, I think, very important in terms of like not having a binary conversation.
Yeah.
Is that they also have to go, horrific things have happened to people and can't be denied and dismissed. Like, but it doesn't matter. She had a flexible hours.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it is about conflate. You know, I just think that we're really bad at not putting it into binaries, as you say. It's either good or it's bad.
Yes.
Or it's this or it's
or
that.
Or wanting people to have rights and choices or not to take away or make their life more difficult, like we talked about Foster and Sester.
Yeah.
Trying to make an already quite a difficult situation even worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't also then mean we're not going to listen to anyone who says they don't enjoy it.
Yeah, and it's like also I think, you know, full disclosure, I didn't have sex with anyone for money.
But yeah, I was going to ask you that, actually.
No, I didn't, but I did obviously entertain it very, very seriously. Mm. And
what was your thinking? Because it's part of you think like, as a documentary maker, if you had been through it, you would have this experience to share, or did you think it would devalue?
I think I was in a relationship at the time, so there was certain boundaries that were in place that I didn't want that to kind of start disrupting what my relationship was at the time. But realistically, when the money and the offers got higher and higher and higher, you really kind of go, okay, this is really quite intense. But weirdly, I did take money.
Yes.
So whilst, you know, I didn't have sex for money, I did provide sexual services.
Yeah.
And I would say that I would 100% say that sugaring is sex work.
Yeah.
But this is the question that I kind of think about quite a bit, which, you know, is when we're locked in this kind of very nascent, I don't even want to use the word debate because it shouldn't be a debate, if whether or not sex work is work.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that's not the question. Sex work is work, but it's like did you ever read the paper that I guess kind of birthed a lot of this called Lust Horizons?
Lust Horizons will be on the show notes along with anything else we've referred to.
It's a really good paper, and it basically is the, you know, it was in the mid-80s at the kind of, you know, the kind of height of Dworkin and the kind of the prostitution wars when it was blah, blah, blah.
Yes,
and it really kind of created this idea of like, we have to actually look again at this, and it's not as easy as good or bad and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there was a really excellent article that I read. I can't remember the author, but maybe I'll kind of dig it up and link it to you. But basically saying that the point of Lust Horizons was to say sex work is here and it's staying.
Mm.
But we have to actually take the conversation beyond that now and go, but what kind of work is it?
Because I think for some people, they do think that there's going to come a point where it won't be necessary anymore. And that would require such a huge revolution.
Yeah. Well, it's also this thing of going, you know, after a while, I just kind of went, you know, I was an actress for many years in Australia, and I was like, that is also a form of sex work.
Well, lots of people do feel that about acting. Yeah. And also, so it's interesting with all the stuff that happened with the first wave of Me Too.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember, there was an actress who'd worked with James Franco. And actually her situation she described, I think most actresses, and perhaps actors as well, like male actresses, but I honestly think it's a really common thing where she got paid a very small amount of money, $100 a day, and then her kind of job got changed while she was there. They were making a film on no budget, which is already actually, everyone's in quite a vulnerable position because you are rushed and everyone's dependent on you. And I don't know if a female actor who hasn't had a situation where they go, no, you're just in your bra.
Yeah.
And 20 people are looking at you and you're like, oh, well, there was no,
this is, you know, it's kind of insane when you actually look.
Well, she was doing sex scenes.
Yeah.
And was nude and afterwards felt really, and people were using the money as she was there to try and get more of her career, and other people were going, $100 a day. It's like, no, you don't understand. It's about boundaries.
Yeah.
And actually, an experienced sex worker, what they absolutely have is, you can do this, you've paid for that, I will do that for you.
Yeah.
And an actress quite often goes in going, like me,
please
employ me again, please extend me to other things.
Yeah.
And your boundaries do get pushed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's a pretty controversial thing to kind of say that, but it's like when you kind of track it back and you go, the abolitionists, you know, 100 years ago were also trying to save actresses from the stage.
Yeah.
It was like, they are fallen women too.
Yeah.
And it's like, like, we see now, and I can see the kind of anger and the frustration from the sex work community to be like, please, Lena Dunham and Meryl Streep and whatever, can you please just fuck off and not, you know, go away?
Also,
with
I think the thing about speaking on people's behalf, like, Neville Southall.
You can find Neville Southall and the incredible work he's doing on Twitter.
Do you know this guy? He's a footballer.
No.
He's a footballer.
Okay.
Or football manager. God, this is how bad my sport is. He exists in sport and he gives his Twitter over every weekend to sex workers and trans activists. So rather than talking on anyone's behalf, it's so amazing.
That's great.
And I just think it's that's, and unfortunately, I absolutely know that there are well-meaning people in Hollywood who also have their ears bent by very powerful bodies.
Yeah.
But there isn't, you can't talk on anyone else's behalf. You have your subjective opinion, which is often uneducated in terms of other people's experience.
Yeah.
And then what you can do is, this is what they say, hear them now.
Exactly. And I think this is some of the work that 50/50 by 2020 is doing quite successfully.
Yeah.
With
representation.
Yeah, so Jill Soloway. So I did a Churchill Fellowship at the end of last year where I was researching gender equity in screen. So I went all around the world and went, well, what's everyone doing? And I spent some time with 50/50 by 2020. And one of the things that they're the radical arm of Time's Up.
Yeah.
And so they did the Transform Hollywood open letter to the studios, which was basically saying trans representation needs to be in the script, on the set, in the casting.
Yeah.
If you are going to try and tell our stories, you need to include us and don't think that you can't.
Yeah.
And the other thing that they're now doing, so they have a sex worker component of that. So they're working on an open letter similarly, which is the same thing of going, you know, you look at the kind of representation, and this has been, you know, a big component of my doc, is looking at the way that the men kind of see themselves and also the women. And they talk about it. Even Brandon Wade talks about it in terms of Pretty Woman. And it's like, we've been telling this story for the happy hooker and for forever. So Hollywood's been making money from this story, but then excluding the people
romanticising it. So you have to exclude reality. So one of the things when I was researching my book, I was going to do this in-depth analysis of Pretty Woman, and then I found out that was... it was taken from the original writer.
3,000.
And it's about a crack addict, and it's all about drugs. And
have you read it?
No.
I'll give it to you. It is out of this world.
So and so there's like little echoes in the current film, in the existing film. It's really, really anti drugs. And so at the beginning, there's a body that's found, and Julia Roberts' character is a bit sad about the woman, and her friend is saying, "Oh, she was a crack whore." Mm. So straight away, they set up this good and bad whores. Mm-hmm. There are drug dependents who you can just dump in the bin.
Yeah.
And then there's Julia Roberts, who actually, when you talk to her, quite clever and she's very kind.
Yeah.
So why not take her away with you and be romantic?
And also, it's like the original scene at the end, because I was actually skirting around reshooting some of the scenes for the film.
Yes.
And the end of the film, actually, because Edward, the Richard Gere's character, is a complete asshole in the in the 3000.
Well, again, there's echoes of that in Pretty Woman. The first scene you see is him shouting on the phone.
Yeah.
And a woman who used to go out with him is now married happily.
And he breaks up companies. Yes. So he's this aggressive shark persona. But the actual end of the film, and you read it and you go, that makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
So the end of the film ends with, so the same kind of thing, she finds out that, you know, he kind of, I think it was the Jason Alexander character, they were kind of in cahoots or something.
Yeah.
And like, you know, so she finds out that he was devaluing her. They have this big kind of like fight in the car. And he gets, so he throws her out of the car, leaves her on the pavement, and then throws $3,000 at her.
Throws it at her.
And the last scene is her on a Greyhound bus going to Disneyland with this dead look in her eyes, and that's it. And it's like the grimmest thing in the whole world. And you're like, that's...
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's a better story, but but I think Pretty Woman... Obviously, it presses people's buttons, because what it's saying is even people that society believe have no worth have all of this worth.
Yeah.
But without questioning the society around it, to go, oh, society needs to change, not the people who do this thing.
Yeah. And also, it's like that.
You shouldn't need to get to know a woman to go, she's just like me.
Yeah, totally.
She has hopes and dreams and doesn't want to be punched in the face.
But it's like that scene where, you know, she is like, just a slut in a store, and then she only has worth because she
money.
Can buy it.
Yes.
And you're like, okay.
A man validates her with a credit card, so now, big mistake, huge. Also, my other thing, my list of problems with that film was that the Jason Alexander character attempts to rape her and is then ejected from the apartment, like, don't try to steal my goods, rather than call the police.
Yeah, you should be.
That's assault.
That's assault.
And also, she was just assaulted in your living room.
But it's okay, because here's another credit card.
Yes.
Like, it's...
Yeah, and I just found that any scene in anything where a woman is assaulted and then she's just fine and everyone around her is like, oh, phew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I know that you, in the book, you talk about Indecent Proposal, and of course that is like, you know...
Well, I didn't watch that until I was an adult. I obviously had watched Pretty Woman as a child and then was rewatching it when I was researching. But Indecent Proposal, I found the most shocking thing.
It's banana.
But the idea, and actually that's what's interesting, comes back to the sugar daddying thing. I did find it, I definitely believed as a teenager, but I was a lot poorer as a teenager than I am now, that this idea that everyone has a price, I absolutely believed that.
Yeah.
And there might be a truth to it. I think there's an area of personal wealth you can get to, it suddenly becomes like a no. But if at any point in your life where an amount of money would mean you wouldn't have to work, would have more work choices.
Yeah.
Yeah, there probably is a point.
And that's very true of my experience. Like, basically it was like, you know, when people were offering me, you know, the arrangement that I'd like is that I'll meet you once a week and I'll give you, so I'm going to talk in dollars because it's Australia. So, you know, and I'll give you $800, and you're kind of like, $800. But then, you know, I met a surgeon who said, the arrangement that I've had successfully is that I'll give you $12,000 a month.
Yeah.
You can stay in my apartment.
Wow.
And if you like, I can give you a car that you can use. Mm. And I was like, well, I don't have a license, but thank you.
Yeah.
But I was like,
sit in the car.
Yeah, but I was like, literally, and you know, you kind of do this mental arithmetic where
you're
like, $12,000, that as a freelancer who works in a creative industry, you go, that's insane.
Yeah.
You know, that is a kind
of... And just the regularity of that, the safety of that platform to then go, then I can live my life in this other way.
And, you know, I kind of like did all of this stuff going, well, you know, even if I'm like the worst sugar baby in the world and like, you know, he boots me out after two weeks, that's still 12 grand in 1 month and blah, blah, blah. So it's just the it's always economic, really.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, this idea, and Brandon talks about this on the website a lot, that it's an equal power exchange.
Yeah.
That somehow wealth and beauty or youth are somehow
interchangeable.
You know, and you just, it's so not true. The experience that you have when you're on something like that is that you know that the capital that you have is always declining.
Well, actually, this is where it's interesting when that's reversed, not just in the explicitness of a sugar daddying situation, but women who are powerful and have money and want to have sex with young, attractive men or young, attractive women. I think they have to be so much, they must be so much more aware of the situation because they're not capitalizing on what they used to have, which was youth.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. We spoke to, when I was in LA, we spoke to some male sugar babies, so not in the gay community, but heterosexual sugar babies. But they, it was kind of this fascinating thing that they, the men that I spoke to, still felt like they were in, had the power.
Yeah.
So it was kind of quite weird because there was this sense that she's an older woman and she's paying me, so I'm totally gaming the system.
But I guess there are lots of kind of women in situations who feel that sexual empowerment similarly. I think for someone with a male body as well, there must be something about, like, I choose to get an erection or not, or maybe they feel physically dominant.
But I also think it's just the way that we talk about, you know, you look at something like American Pie and like Stifler's mum.
Yeah.
And it's still the young guy's the hero, you know?
Yes,
so there's this heroicness around, or heroism around your capacity to kind of like get something out of an older woman, or it's subversive. And I think that it's socially supported. So the men, and there were
it's
very
It's interesting because actually I don't know if you've ever watched Angry Men on YouTube or on like Reddit threads.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of the Angry Men because actually their anger is always they feel that's what's happening to them, that women are so sexually manipulative that they trick you, they ensnare you, they use their wiles and then you think they like you for you, and their fury is always, now she wants me to do the washing up.
Yeah, exactly, because we're all witches, actually.
Yes,
yeah.
But they do, they absolutely feel... Yeah, bewitched is a very good way of putting it, that some spell has been put upon them by the female body and then this evil person within
and,
it.
Well, it's just, it's this kind of strange thing. I mean, I met a lot of very angry men.
Were there any of the sugar daddies who were angry they were having to pay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. The interesting thing was that the more I was myself, so I would talk to them about like feminism or whatever, and I quickly learned that's not the...
Yeah, people hate feminism.
Yeah, they really don't like it. I mean, one guy, we were at this really expensive restaurant and I was kind of like, whoa, this is kind of a little bit fancy. And I, you know, had one glass of wine too many. So I was kind of just like, you know, waxing lyrical around like feminism or whatever. And it turned into this like insane thing where he was kind of very politely shouting at me that I was the reason that society was falling apart because women like me who are too uppity to just be traditional women, you know, we don't know our place and all of that stuff. And I was kind of like, wow, this is really insane, because what the website says, or what I think a lot of women think, is that, well, I'm a young I'm a younger person to this person, but I've got some kind of level of beauty or youth and my brain, and you are interested in that. And actually,
definitely, I should say, they set out on the website, a lot of the point of it is to have interesting discussion with an interesting, fully rounded person. But one of the romanticized elements of it is you're gonna be with an equal.
Yeah.
Because,
And the more and more and more I was myself, as if I was dating someone, the less and less successful I was, actually.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. There's a sweet spot, actually, where you have to perform yourself.
Yes.
So I was more successful as a better version of Sophie than I was as Hope.
Yes.
But when I was actually me, like, if, you know, it would be like, oh, thanks so much. Here's the consolation money. Peace out. See ya.
Yeah. I think that's some people's experience of dating in general, is that the early stages, lots of my friends who are on Tinder and similar, sometimes their horror stories involve just them finding out something like, they've been on the guilty feminist. That word is triggering to them.
Yeah.
Because they have an idea of what feminism is, or what it's to blame for, or what it says about that person.
So it's like, I got a lot of anger because I think the more I inferred that I didn't need them or that potentially I wasn't asking them to shape my understanding or experience.
Yeah.
They just weren't interested in it at all. They really wanted, they wanted to a level of paternalism, actually.
Yes, paternalism, yes. Because I was thinking messiah complex, but it's not. It's of course, it's daddying.
Yeah, yes, 100%.
Did they ever ask about your real dad?
Weirdly, no. I did actually, I went
Because I would want to know, do you have a daughter my age?
So I actually, so there was one guy that I went on a few dates with and he was actually really lovely. But he had a daughter who was 20, I think. Mm. And I kind of spoke to him very honestly about like, what would you do if she was on this? Yeah. Like if it was, and he was just like, look, I don't think she needs to. So he was acknowledging that she economically isn't driven to do it.
It's a need,
But he did say, he was like, if she was, I would just say be cautious, vet them well and know what you're getting in yourself into. Yes. And I was kind of like, okay, well, fine.
Yeah, I think absolutely. If you're going to engage in the world, the double standards, which is all about obviously owned fertility, as in that's going to that's mine as well. My daughter's mine. Prospective other women, they're all mine separately. No, none for other men. Thank you. Isn't it? But I think that's actually pretty. Sounds like a pretty stand-up guy in that respect to go, if it's legitimate for you, someone else's daughter, then it's legitimate for my daughter.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the ability to hold those two things in his head at once, I was kind of like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, one of the things that I was constantly coming back to is actually going, how can you look at the marketing materials of this realistically and go, I don't have some uninterrogated misogynistic beliefs about women. Like it's so set up with these kind of very like.
I think that this is where the word misogyny, because everyone understands it to be like hatred of women. Mm-mm. But you can, misogyny in this aspect can involve like, you know, when you're like, I love women. I want to buy them handbags.
Yeah.
I want to have sex with them so they can go to school. I love women. Because I guess that is the thing that these people wouldn't identify as in any way a hatred.
No, no.
And but what they do is go, I want to liberate them to have my children in the home. I want them to stop thinking,
Yeah, I want to unburden them of like, they don't have to be men, you know?
So
like,
to go back, the thing I originally had asked, the man that you had the audio file of.
Yes, yes, yes. Sorry, this is the it was the longest tangent.
I think it's actually really great because what it's done at the beginning, you've gone, well, what about that guy? And now they're going to finally get the payoff. And it does match up to that whole idea of like roles.
Yeah. Mm. So basically he kind of said, you know, when I asked him, why not a sex worker? And he was like, I don't want to be a John, but, you know, this is a way that I can, you know, have my needs met, spend some time with younger women, and it's cheaper than my ex-wife. And I was like, okay, there's something there. Let's pull that thread. And he said, well, you know, my attorney said to me when I was divorcing my first wife, you take the years that you've been married, times that by your annual salary, and divide that by the amount of times you had sex, and that's your pay per fuck. And that realistically should be what you're offering these women if you're going to do that.
Yeah.
So he was like, you know, and I was like, whoa, okay. Yeah. And he was like, PPF. And I was like, that is not an acronym that I ever want to hear in the world. But like the idea that the economic bargain that he was striking was something that he conflated with marriage.
Yeah. But what's so interesting, because actually in Australia, do you remember when they tried to have a sex strike?
Yeah.
And so actually, I think the other way, they were for a long period of time. Look, I think the world's getting better. And for people who have their own forms of income through work or the ability to work, they're the luckiest women in the world, basically. Mm. And but there are women generations before us who didn't have that.
Mm.
And especially if they were going to have a family, they didn't have that.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't technically illegal. So they were dependent. If they were straight, they were dependent on men. And they absolutely knew that they were doing drudgery in the home and weren't getting paid and then were expected. We also know that the laws, literally a wife's body was the husband's property and she could not deny him sex. There wasn't rape within marriage.
Yeah, of course.
So I think they, for a long time, those women understood that this was an economic bargain, that they had been bought, they were bought, and sometimes not enough money. So the idea of like withholding sex, as in like that was the currency, which is the exact inversion of this.
And I think the economics of marriage is something that does need to be assessed. You know, we need to be talking about this, because I think, you know, it is kind of strange sometimes that, you know, and it's not to cast aspersions, but the reclaiming of marriage as if there is not something deeply kind of strange within the kind of foundation stone
It's built on, this is why I think it's really interesting, gay marriage in particular, because I think it's a do-over.
Because
it is equals for whatever reason, whether it's kind of economic safety in terms of, if one person dies, you have legal rights. And there's all these kind of things, but there isn't this gendered expectations of what your roles will be within marriage.
Yeah.
So I had this silly idea of like, oh, straight people need to get gay married. Like, that's how you solve it. Is we get rid of the whole idea of like God being there, or that it's a religious ceremony, or any kind of virginity, or white dresses, or bridesmaids, like maids who are literally kind of being like shown and for the other men in the congregation.
And it's like, you know, even just the idea of like, you know, your father
gives you away because he owns you and gives you to the next guy. And also, when my sister got married, I hadn't realized that it was a tradition for everyone to speak apart from the bride.
Is this an actual thing?
Yeah, so father of the bride, speech, and then the groom, speech, and then best man, speech. Women do not talk at weddings. Why? Because it's a miserable day. Well, your dad sells you like a donkey to another man. Like, of course you were. It was going to be awful. Like, oh, God.
And now it's the bride's tearful exchange.
Yes, it's not her chance to go.
God, that's
should be
awful.
Better. Yeah, it is.
That's awful.
It is, and I know that because people feel more autonomous now. So even things like, and this is where people, so like, say for instance, taking a man's surname, like becoming part of his family, is seen as a romantic thing. As in, someone might go, "I love his surname, and I want to be Mrs. da 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 da." But we should acknowledge the history, because we're kind of play-acting something now where we feel we're doing really bad S&M. Yes. Going, wasn't it funny? We've got fluffy handcuffs.
Yeah.
But those handcuffs were there for a reason.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, the assessment of that is coming, whether or not you deny it or not, when you look at what sugaring is, there's all of those threads of all of this stuff.
Yes.
So, you know, actually hearing it from men and going, well, they do see, they recognize marriage as an economic bargain.
Yeah.
And I think,
well, it costs them so much money.
Yeah.
I read a book by a Mennonist called Peter Lloyd, and a lot of it, he's very angry, but some of his points are really reasonable.
Right.
Which is difficult because some of it's put really hatefully.
Yeah.
But the pushback from men going, why am I paying for women?
Yeah.
And like, I completely agree.
Yeah.
Like, let's create a society where everyone is, there aren't these gendered expectations.
But then I think one of the things that's kind of really tough is that, you know, the even the capacity to go Dutch on something, right? You need to have no gender pay gap for that to be the case.
Yeah.
So the idea of suddenly like, well, now everyone pays.
Yes.
I'm still a little bit like, you know.
But again, this is where I think gay people have it. So basically they're much more sensible. So basically with gay people, the person who asks the other person out usually pays, as in, so you can still have a romantic gesture.
Yeah.
But it's not gendered. It's not like, oh, you're the man, I'm the woman in this, masculine, feminized behaviors. And then people either take turns or they have discussions about the expense of the place that they're going to.
Yeah.
It just all seems so reasonable
and
without
also,
anyone being undermined or emasculated is a word.
Yeah totally. Or even just the negotiation around children and childbearing and how that happens.
Yes.
It's something that's highly negotiated and it's something that needs to be, people need to come together, I guess, and actually figure out what are our priorities with this.
Yes.
Because I think there's so much misinformation between both sides, I think, between men and women when you look at this.
Yeah, and also kind of learned and unlearned behaviors. We have things that we just think are right and wrong. We haven't questioned them. And societally, because yes, there is a wage gap, but it doesn't affect white women my age. And so, especially childless women my age.
Yeah.
And so, But the only people I hear talking about it are white women my age, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And that's not to devalue their arguments and the fact that there are things that absolutely have to be improved. But we're the most privileged group. If I was then to go into a bar and go, you buy my wine to a man, I don't think that is empowerment. I think that's madness.
Well, I think it's also this thing of going, you know, there were times where I literally could not afford the place that we were eating in.
Yes.
So then the idea of going Dutch. And this
must be so strange because you're literally eating a thing going, if he doesn't offer to pay.
I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Literally. Like, and that is, it's terribly anxiety making because you actually, and that's where the indebtedness becomes a thing because you go, I can't be here. And that's, it comes back to Pretty Woman of going, if it's just her, she's in thigh-high boots and her own clothes being, you know, called a slut and get out trampy.
Yeah.
But if she has the economic safety net of him and his credit card, she's suddenly treated better, has access to things that she could never get without him.
Yeah.
So there is, you know, and I think this is where it becomes really tricky that knowing that I couldn't, you know, there were some times where I was on a date and I had $4 in my bank account and I was like, God, if he, you know, if he wants something from me.
Have you read Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Not the book. No, I haven't.
So Breakfast at Tiffany's, she goes on dates and she gets money to go on them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that I think is just completely omitted from the film. And certainly her as an iconic figure, this Holly Golightly, it's completely missed out that she's a sex worker.
Yeah.
So what she does, the way she gets money, they go to lovely restaurants and she says, I'm going to go and powder my nose. And they say, for the toilet attendant, and give her $50. So every time she goes to the bathroom, she gets $50 or $25. And that's how she makes her money.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's completely missed out because actually it's the really, for me, that's a really interesting detail with that story.
That is so amazing. And also that the transaction, again, is veiled.
Yes.
It's not, here's your payment.
No.
It's, oh, I'm helping you because that's...
There's this kind of just little slight... All for the toilet attendant, for the toilet attendant. But that's how she funds her lifestyle. That's how she exists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, she's like the original
sugar
baby. Sugar that's amazing. Baby. That's amazing.
Yeah. So the language of it, when the people like who go to sugar baby conferences, none of them kind of shudder with the word baby.
It's a really tricky one because I think, you know, no. I think a lot of women, myself included, were kind of like, well, this is what it is. Mm. This is, you know.
Did they ever want to be called daddy?
No, not really. I mean, there is a real high proportion of men who are quite dominant and say on their profiles,
oh, yeah,
I want a submissive.
Yeah. So basically, don't question me.
But almost like sexually, like, you know, so there is a large...
They like to tell people what to do.
Yeah. And they're just like, are you a good baby? That's like a common opener.
That's so interesting because I was finding out recently someone was telling me in terms of sex work, they're quite often very powerful men. That's why they love to be babied because actually that's why they like to be they go to doms because they actually want someone to tell them off.
Well, I mean, I wonder whether or not I don't think I ever went on a date with anyone who had that in their profile because literally the guys who had that were just saying, meet me in a hotel. And I was like, not really, no.
Yeah.
But I think most of the guys, definitely there was some sense that, and this is, from an ethnographic perspective, I think a lot of them wanted to prove things not only to the women that they were with, myself or others, but to other men. Actually, they were looking at women as some kind of object or a symbol of virility, or
status. I think it reflects status
or cachet.
It?
Yeah. You know, a lot of these guys were some of them had just come out of really serious relationships, and I think were a little bit wounded. So it was kind of this thing of going, they utilized the kind of youth or beauty or something of a younger woman to give them some reinvigoration of their social standing, but not for other women, but for men.
Yes.
So it is quite strange in that way that it's almost, you know, some men would kind of talk about, and I heard it a lot on dates, that they would be like, well, it's the kind of the same thing as a nice car, right?
Yeah.
And you're like,
one, women aren't cars. Yeah. Like, you know.
But I guess if you can buy something, then it becomes an object you buy.
Exactly. And it's peacockery. Yes. They're doing that, you know. And I think that, you know, we use some of the some clips from 16 Candles in the film, because that film is just about women are objects that men use to show their social status to each other. So the geek gets this girl and then the girl, you know, isn't a woman anymore.
But also what's very interesting with that, I don't know if they cover it in 16 Candles, but women are attracted to men with attractive women. So actually quite often we also make a subconscious judgment about a man of like, well, he must have something going on. Because at that beautiful woman with him.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Is that some kind of
biological? It's just evolution. This thing about the transaction, unfortunately, like the studies that I read for my book, I found really depressing. I'd find it depressing also because I'm a woman nearing the end of my fertility, but I also I'm successful for the first time in my life and I have money. So I find my life so inverted. So when I read these studies about women respond better to men in nice cars, or they change the labels on men's clothing, and women had to rate their attractiveness 1 to 10, and we're just very unconsciously aware. Some women explicitly aware. There was a meme the other day from an activist stripper that I follow, and it said, "There's no such thing as a gold digger. Don't mess with women out of your price range." And while I thought that was very funny, how funny, and I understand that. I can understand where it might give someone this little fizz of, that's my worth, pay for me.
Yeah.
But you're still treating everything, all relationships as a transactional nature.
But also there's something about, you know, that worth is not fixed, and yet there is a kind of a scale.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, what then does that make of people who are non-able bodied,
and the frustration, I think, especially for men at the lower end of the economic scale, and women who don't have you have women who don't want to use beauty and youth. They want to be ignored. They want to wear tracksuits. They want to be able to be a lawyer, be an astronaut, work as a chemist without being hassled or even looked at. And then you have the opposite, which is men who are being told you're not worthy to society, or you can't compete for this reason.
Well, I think that, it's the competition that's the issue. And I think until we start to have more analysis of that, the structures around
apparently that's the thing that with internet dating, which I've never done, has apparently really changed the playing field. If you think of us as all being from tribes that were about 150 people, so our competition existed, but it was limited. And then you had competition between tribes. What we have now is something where everyone can be so fussy that everyone's what do they call it? It's not erotic capital, but mate value. Everyone's mate value is now so devalued.
Wow.
Because for women, you are now not in competition with 30 women in your age bracket.
We all went public and just crashed the stocks.
That's what's happened.
Crazy.
We're all worth nothing because we're now swipeable past when you used to,
Well, this is the thing that's kind of insane about, like, seeking, is that it says really explicitly, like, 8 babies to every daddy. So literally, it's like, even if you're in an exchange with one guy, you know that he's already thinking about the other 7 that are behind you. And it was kind of insane. Like, you know, even if Brandon is like, well, it's just a regular dating website, I was like, I have never been on more dates with dudes that just felt like a really good opener is to neg other women or talk about, you know, the fact that the last date that he'd been on, she was heaps fatter than her profile picture and what a time waster and blah, blah. And I was like, wow, this is pretty, that's not really normal. But it's like, that's the thing where in a devalued thing, it's like, I can devalue you further.
Yes. Well, that's it, I think, about any kind of form of objectification. It's why, so like people who look at pornography or even like Page 3 girls and glamour models, they're 2D representations. They do suddenly talk about women's bodies or bodies in general as bits, as parts, as big tits and like flat tits and all this kind of thing, like pieces of people. Which I guess women, I mean, I'm saying that the big dick thing is a whole other, obviously men can have the same kind of thing done to them.
Well,
what was the inspiration, the real genesis for, I want to make a film about seeking arrangement and sugar daddying?
I was at university and I was studying my master's and making my first feature at the time. And there was a woman who was in the university who was outed as a sugar baby while I was there. And I just witnessed what the conversation was around the kind of like, you know, the student water coolers and this kind of really strange, you know, kind of.
Was it salacious? Like as in it's saucy gossip, big deal, yeah.
And pretty much it was like 50% of the conversation I heard was basically like, she's so empowered, she's got this guy paying for her, blah, blah, blah. And then 50% saying she's exploited, she's a prostitute, she's whatever.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And I think in Melissa Gira-Grant's book, Playing the Whore, she kind of talks about that. That is what, like the kind of baseline question that is commonly kind of attached to sex work is it empowerment or is it exploitation?
Something she also puts really well, I think, is that it on what end of the spectrum people have. There's a real snobbery between high class escorting, which is if you get paid in the hundreds per hour, that is seen often as empowerment. Whereas if you are knocking on car windows and getting paid in tenors for an act, that's seen as a completely different thing.
Yeah.
So again, we are so snobby about the amount someone is paying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is why an indecent proposal can be made, because if it's $1 million, no one's a slag.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But like now it would have to be like more than $1 million, because I think, you know, our value.
I know, but imagine if it had just been £500. Yeah. A man in a casino comes up and you've got, they've just lost all the, also that's so stupid. But anyway, they've got no money and someone says £500 to have sex
and
tonight.
Pretty much what we know about rich people, it would be £500.
It would be £500. Yeah. He still gets the whole power trip.
Yeah. He would just be like, that's a lot of money to you right now, because everything is in an offshore account.
Yes.
But I was just really fascinated in the way that sugaring was spoken about, and the only people that were talking about it were women, sugar babies. Mm. And I really wanted to not to just say, well, what about the Johns? But I actually went, well, where are the men in this conversation?
Yeah.
What is the driver for them to be on this? Because I knew that that's where the story is, effectively.
Did you find out? Because that's something I'm very interested in. Also, I'm scared of those kind of men.
Yeah.
But so my first thing is like, do they get recommended it by other men?
Yes.
Do they? Yeah. So there's a community. So someone at work or brother-in-law might say, hey, you know what you should do now?
Or they see it in the media, or, you know, I think that this idea of like, they see it in romantic comedies, you know, they see it in cultural messages everywhere.
Mm.
And I think that for them, it's so normalized, you know, it was kind of interesting. There was this sense, like it's the craziest kind of dating website, in inverted commas, because you literally go on it and most men don't have eyes, they just have black bars, and you're like,
So they put a picture up, but they then disguise themselves.
Yeah, there is the funniest picture that I will definitely send to you of a guy that had literally made himself into a Guess Who character.
Oh, really?
He had like fake glasses and a hat and a beard, and I was like, this is not a human, this is a bunch of like, you know,
emojis. Yeah.
It was kind of mental, but the sense that they had to be clandestine about it was really important.
Yeah, but I guess shame and stigma on their side as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
But a lot of the men were married, and, you know, that was kind of interesting as well to kind of talk to men about.
Did you talk to anyone's wife, like anyone who knew about it? No.
No, I didn't actually. You know, I heard some stories about, you know, through different sugar daddies or sugar babies. I heard different stories about women who were aware of that but turned a blind eye. But mostly I think men just kept it well away. I think it's because also there is so much stigma.
Yeah.
Sugar babies are kind of universally hated, actually. They're hated by the sex workers because they are really devaluing.
Yes.
And in the same way that like taxi drivers hate Uber.
Yes.
You know, it's the same thing because sex workers are going, you are accepting $200 a night and an overnight is $4,000. And so then my value is that, you know, so it's really shifting the economics of sex work and independent
escorts.
And
did you find that lots of the babies didn't want to ally themselves with sex workers?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
They really, by and large, they did not self-identify as sex workers, which meant that there were some real quirks around that, where when you couch this as a kind of relationship, does that necessarily mean that you are more lax with things like condoms, like, you know,
yes,
because it's not then seen as a commercial transaction. Mm. So it's not, you know, and I think men, a lot of the men, despite the fact that they were saying I would never see a sex worker, when I kind of pushed them hard enough, they were kind of talking about the perks that sugar babies could provide that traditional sex workers probably wouldn't.
Or charge a lot more for.
Yeah, it's like,
they wouldn't
expect
that to just be thrown in.
Exactly, this idea of, like, they will treat you like a girlfriend, so they'll kiss you on the mouth and they'll be in, you know, and they'll all of those things, they're there for you. Mm. So it really is...
Have you seen The Girlfriend Experience?
Yeah.
What did you think of that show?
I thought it was weirdly cold and I think quite... it glamorized it still, which I think...
I thought what was interesting was that they choose to show sex in this show, but it's very slow, respectful, affectionate sex, which I thought such an odd decision. I didn't watch all of it. They choose ugly men, so I thought, okay, so it's not like... Because I've been watching all... I was trying to look at media representation, so I watched Client List. Have you seen that?
Oh, my God, it's... It is just
everyone should watch it and then get a day off work so we all need to talk about this show, because you know, you think you've seen bad television.
Oh my God, it is just something else.
I found it so interesting because I watched Magic Mike and I thought, oh God, everything that has anything to do with erotic capital, transactional sex or sexual behaviours has to legitimate it by going, this person has got no money. So you can't just be like, do you know what? I want to wiggle for a living. It has to be. And also the fact that he quits for a girlfriend. So they basically just still reverse the same kind of moralistic story.
Mm-mm.
Client List. It's just an astonishing piece of television, isn't it? Like, in terms of the fakery, and also she's offering wives this service because they talk to her, and then there's an episode where she cries and says, he doesn't love me, it's you he wants to have sex with, and the wife's like, thank you so much for what you did for my marriage. So moralistic, so judgy, and she just in a negligee. She's obviously never massaged anyone, even in her personal life. Like, she's like rubbing above where they are in an oily way that would not be satisfying either sexually or for any muscular injury. It's like
aromatherapy massage, which is just nothing. It's like get in there with elbows.
Yeah, and it's like flirty, like, would you like to turn over? Would you like me to?
Yeah.
It's just like, wank them off. Wank them off, get your $20. Like, something so moralistic. And the other one, which I actually thought was the one with the couple. It's another Netflix show, You, Me and Her.
Oh, my God. Yes.
So that was, I thought, had the most dangerous messages of all of the cultural ones, which is that a man is recommended that he should, and a girl who's at university is told she should sell sex, one of her friends does it.
Yeah.
And then they all fall in love, the three of them.
Which is absurd.
So it becomes not about the money, which was the original reason she was there.
Yeah.
Was she was only there for money.
Weirdly, one of the things is just kind of a little tangent, but Brandon Wade has Seeking Arrangement, but he also has four other websites.
Yes.
What's Your Price, Miss Travel, blah, 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 all other economic stuff.
Yeah.
But weirdly...
So they're still selling sex?
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
But there is one, and he kind of said to me, like, off camera...
Mm.
That, you know, he was like, I think the institution of marriage is really tired and it needs to be revised and whatever. So he started this website called Open Minded, which was basically about, you know, non-traditional relationships.
Yes,
so polyamorous and, you know, dyads and triads and whatever. But he said to me, because he was like, you know, I just, when he was divorcing his wife, he was like, I'm just not sure that, you know, I'm just not sure that marriage is for me and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, so why are you kind of like still doubling down with Seeking Arrangement? Why don't you just throw everything into Open Minded? And he was like, because I can't monetize it.
Yeah.
And I was like, aha.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, these things around, you know, the like with You, Me and Her, the economic thing is the driver of a lot of these behaviours, and that's where those kind of practices, they kind of live and breathe, but you kind of see that it does expose something about the actual, like, you know, the marital disharmony that's going on for that couple.
Yeah.
Potentially they shouldn't actually just stay together at all. Like, you kind of look at it and you go, you don't like each other.
Yeah.
Like, you just should stop being together, actually.
Yeah.
And this sex worker should probably just get paid and go back to her life,
I know,
too.
And that's a much more kind of anarchic message to give to people. Like, you don't have to stay.
Yeah.
Like, we're trying to set up a society where people are free.
Yeah.
Free, which means free to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for talking to me about this. Tell us a bit more about the film and where people can find your work.
So it's still in production at the moment.
Yes.
Basically, you won't be able to find it for a little bit of time.
Yes.
But my the production company is called Little Sure Shots, so it's littleshoreshots.com.
Yeah.
And we also have sugarthedocumentary.com, but that's just basically a landing page. I don't really do social media because I don't like getting trolled because I'm a feminist, so I don't really do that. But, you know, basically this is a thing that will be launching in 2020, so you can just kind of
if anyone's listening with a lot of money, they want to invest into films, which I believe is tax deductible.
Yeah, the EIS.
If your business or company would like to see an incredible documentary that's much more open-minded and discursive about the way that people are living now, you know where to go.
And I'm a really great companion too, so I'll go on some dates with you as
well. $12,000 a month. Okay, that's all you need. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends. Thank you so much to Sophie Matheson. Next week, my guest will be Anna Arrowsmith, an academic and pawnmaker. See you then.